Hello and welcome to Docupied, an intellectual podcast for the chosen ones. I'm your host, Brandon, otherwise known as Doc Pei. For you first-time listeners out there, I am a long-time anime manga fan. I currently live in Tokyo, and I work for a anime producer, distributor, publisher, etc. Docupied is a weekly, bi-weekly podcast. I've given up attempting to contain it to 30 minutes because I feel like I just talk too much. So hopefully everyone doesn't mind. Typically, I host Occupied myself, and occasionally I'll be bringing on guest co-hosts. Last episode, I brought on Steiner, a longtime friend of mine. We talked about lots of great stuff, different industry perspectives, and if you haven't listened to it, make sure you give it a listen. It's really interesting. And I'll be announcing the next guest co-host at the end of this podcast, so look forward to that. I'll start out today by talking a little bit about Anime Central. That was like 3 weeks or so ago, and I didn't get a chance to talk about it after I got back or in the last podcast, so I'm going to talk a little bit about it here before I get started. I went to Anime Central for the first time this year, met some really great people, had a really good time, and I was participating as an industry person. We ran a booth, I hosted my first panel, and things like that. What made it really fun was we had some really great people at the booth helping out, and things were just really smooth, really nice. Overall, just really enjoyed the time I spent there with and meeting other fans, things like that. But next door to me in the hotel, there was a group of loud youngins next door. I could hear them talking, and they were talking about things like college, and I think even one of them wasn't like even in college yet, so young people. I mean, comparatively, I'm not that much older, but I'm still older, and they were still youngins, simply because of the way they were acting, and they were so obnoxiously loud until, like, obnoxiously late at night, every night, so I barely got any sleep, and I was just exhausted. You work a booth all day, you know, setting up, tearing down, doing all that stuff, and then you get back to your hotel and you just want to kind of eat and crash, and you can't because a group of drunk young kids next door won't let you. I considered changing rooms, but it wasn't worth it for the short amount of time and the trouble. And I considered complaining, but I know how kids are, they just get worse. So I just put up with it. But yeah, all that said to me that when I got back to Japan after the 14-hour flight, I was exhausted and slept for basically an entire day after I got back. You know, that was nice. I was so tired and just, oh, that sleep felt so nice. See, I can tell a short story. Who'd have thought? Moving on, I'm going to talk about some of this week's anime episodes. But first, let me explain that, you know, I think a lot of people kind of already share their opinions on weekly anime. You can find, you know, blogs and reviews and other podcasts that talk about it. So I'm also going to start highlighting a single series that's been on my mind, similar to what I did with those three manga series from episode 2 of Docupied. I'll be able to provide kind of a more fleshed out discussion than just like a weekly reaction or impression to an episode. So I'm only going to talk about a couple weekly series each time, but if you want to know what I think about other currently airing anime that I don't talk about, you know, just ask me via my Ask FM, Twitter, the Hummingbird group, in the comments on SoundCloud or wherever. Ask me there and, you know, I'll answer. I watch most things and I'm aware and follow with most things anyway, so I just figured it would be better for the podcast if I were to give a more detailed discussion rather than just kind of meandering through the weekly series. Although if you disagree and you want to hear more weekly series reactions and impressions and analysis, well then, you know, feel free to ask for it. Before I get into any discussion about anime or manga series, I'm just going to have a general spoiler warning going forward. If you haven't watched any of the episodes I'm going to talk about, I may include some plot points, so you have been warned. First up on my list are Joker Game episodes 7 to 9. So, episode 7, we start with the assassination aboard the Tokimaru, which is a cruise ship bound for Hawaii. This one features yet another one of our D-Agency boys, and he's out to find a British spy. That is his mission on this episode. I won't say too much about the plot for this particular episode, simply because the, I suppose, twist, you would call it, is fairly obvious if I mention kind of anything about it. This episode kind of centers around keeping an encryption method used by the Germans in World War II secret, and that was the Enigma machine. And now, actually, kind of unrelated to this particular episode, but I studied and researched cryptology in the past, meaning this particular focus, even the brief little discussion they had regarding cryptology, and that if you know the input and the output from an encryption technique, you can attempt to decipher it, decrypt the information based on knowing the input and having the output. You can attempt to figure out the method that changed it, that encrypted it, basically. You know, that's a pretty basic concept in the world of cryptology, but I thought it was interesting at the very least, especially considering given this time period, how vitally important it was that they cracked the Enigma machine. If you know anything about World War II history, I won't get into that here too much, or no, let's just skip it, not at all. But anyway, the Enigma machine was a method of encrypting and securing data to be sent to troops. It was a way of securing intelligence. For me, that was exciting to see, even if it wasn't particularly the focus of the episode. This episode was actually a very human-driven drama, showing the kind of polarity and the emotions on both sides of the story. You have aspects of good on the bad side, you have aspects of bad on the good side. There were lots of interesting dynamics at play in this episode, and I thought that was a very well done and tasteful portrayal of some of the more personal sides during something as big as like World War II. We're not out to, you know, talk about big ideologies between countries or anything like that. It drops it down to a personal level, and I thought that was a really interesting way of going about the story. And then we have episodes 8 and 9, which are a two-parter, and they focus on a World War II Japanese spy agency Double Joker spy-off. So we have two agencies working within the Japanese government, both attempting to thwart a particular threat to Japanese intelligence. Basically, the British consul was thought to have been in possession of Japan's grand strategy, and the agencies were tasked with figuring out whether that was true and to stop that information from leaking because they thought it was of vital importance. So in the first part of the two-parter, we have an interesting use of the audience's expectation regarding the flow of the episode. And I thought that the way that they twisted the audience's expectation from the previous 7 episodes was quite entertaining. And they used that as a way to introduce our opposing spy agency, the Wind Agency. Now, I won't, again, spoil it because the whole point of that episode was that interesting dynamic and twist. But suffice it to say that you do notice the signs early on, and if you're perceptive, you'll figure it out. And they make it obvious towards the end of the episode. That's all. Episode 9, the second part of the two-parter, I thought that the conclusion was fantastic. I don't think saying this is a spoiler of any kind, because I don't think any of us watching this show expect the D agency to fail or be beaten at anything. So I will just say this outright, is that the Wind Agency gets completely thrashed in the Double Joker game. So badly that even a bunch of random Inn employees had realized who they were to an extent. For spies, that is just a horrible failure and quite amusing. Tied in with that, I thought it was quite interesting how they kind of only hint at it, but our D agency boy in this episode, he seemed to be reporting to Yuki through visits to the waitress at the inn that the Wind Agency guys were all staying at. And that's also how Yuki managed to ruin their day. So I found that super interesting. They kind of only hinted at it through the relationship that they kind of offhandedly mentioned between our D agency boy and one of the girls, one of the waitresses at the inn. You have that dual usage there where that relationship is likely a cover to report to Yuki. and it was also how he was able to keep his advantage in the spy off and retain his target as an asset. One other thing I really loved about this two-parter was how Yuki completely tore down the Imperial Army's bullshit at the time, and Japan's kind of nationalism in general. He essentially said that their nationalism holds them back, that that grand strategy that they went to all this effort to try and protect and keep from leaking to enemy countries and things like that held zero strategic value as information and was worthless in terms of a spy agency's time in collecting or protecting. And yet, the Imperial Army officers had made such a big deal of this grand strategy that must be protected, and Yuki just thrashed it. And there was an also interesting tidbit of information regarding the Japanese Imperial Army's emblem that they typically wear on their uniform, that they hold so much value for anyone in the army, and in terms of nationalist pride and things like that, they place so much value in it because it's meant to harken back to the golden days of yore in Japan, when in modern reality, it is simply a worthless piece of junk to anyone else. The way he foiled their plan, thrashed their values, and flat out rejected the information as worthless, I thought was just fantastic. Next up on our list is Kurumukuro, episode 729. Once again, Kurumukuro has surpassed expectations for me. Things have been going smoothly, it's been super interesting, and a lot's going on with some great character development, character moments, and interesting plot developments. Overall, I'm just really, really enjoying this show so far, and I can't wait to see how it continues to develop. One thing I found hilariously interesting in episode 7 was that Japan was the only country to successfully repel the invaders. You know, of course it is. Anyway, it seems our outer space invaders are surveying the planet for some reason. They sent robots to various locations around the world, one of them, for example, being Area 51 in the US, and they mentioned in one of the later episodes that they actually took something from it, and I'll get into that in a little bit when I talk about one of the next episodes. So, episode 7, we have things like Sophie out-Japanesing the Japanese people, and I got a great kick out of that because it's something I can actually really relate to, being someone who also studied Japanese history and culture, classic literature, things like that. Occasionally, I end up out-Japanesing actual Japanese people who have no interest in those things, and I'm sure that happens in plenty of cultures, but I related to that quite strongly, so I got a good kick out of it. This episode was the obligatory swimsuit episode with a pool class, and we got to see some interesting time, out-of-time culture clashes with the pool scene and Ken Nosuke using a tablet and things like that. We also got to see inside the mothership orbiting, well, I guess it's a mothership, orbiting the planet, so, oh god, we advanced civilization now. Effie Dorg actually has a homeworld, and they seem to send out squads to subdue other planets, and it seems something kind of empire-ish. I guess we'll learn more about their homeworld and their civilization as we go on. The episode mentions something about collecting a pivot stone and some kind of non-responsive keystone. I'm assuming these are things that are used for some kind of ancient weapon or device that they lost, 450 years ago, back when they were here the last time. So, curious to see what develops of that. That's one of the things that they stole from Area 51 in the US, so who knows what's going on. In episode 8, we learn that the Kurumukuro and Kenosuke's sword appear to absorb surrounding matter to repair themselves. So I actually really like this idea, because it kind of helps alleviate the problem they'd run into later on if either of them gets really damaged. Well, the sword was broken, and it's repaired itself. And same thing with the Kurumukuro. Because of the technological difference and gap between the Kurumukuro and And like the UN's current development, they actually can't repair it themselves. They can't just use parts from one of the other mech robots or anything like that. So this is kind of an interesting way that they've done it, is that they tend to repair themselves. And I liked that there's that interesting gap and way of making up for kind of a potential hole in the story later on. As a side note, all of those PA Works posters in Mika's room were a nice touch, and I enjoyed seeing them all, because I've enjoyed several of those works before, so it was nice to kind of see it. And she also had some really weird outfits in her closet, but yeah, if you get to that scene, you'll know what I'm talking about. There was a scene later on where Ken Nosuke is asking for people's help and opinion on a website with something like, you know, Yahoo Answers or whatever like that, and his shitposting is just hilarious. Honestly, I just bust out laughing with that whole scene. Quite enjoyed that part. If you recall in a previous episode of DocuPod, I mentioned that those two idiots, the guy who likes to live stream and the guy with the beanie who's following around Yukina, I mentioned that I hope at some point they get killed for being so goddamn stupid. Well, they just keep doing it. So seriously, though, they are going to get killed off at some point for being so stupid, right? Right? I hope so. Moving on, episode 8 ends with this mysterious savior with his own kind of AI cactus thing. And overall, the episode was interesting. By the end of it, you know, before I saw episode 9, I was a bit kind of put off at Yukina. But, I mean, I guess that kind of reaction she had was bound to happen. You know, if you throw a normal high school girl into an intergalactic war that dates back 450 years, she's bound to react kind of negatively and not want to be thrown into that mix. She's had her moments of being a decent protagonist, and her relationship with Ken Nosuke up to this point has been pretty interesting and enjoyable. So I was actually really, really glad when I saw episode 9, and she didn't end up staying in that annoying phase for very long. So it's nice to see a protagonist kind of go through that and then jump back out and get right back on that horse, literally and metaphorically. In episode 9, we meet her mysterious, definitely not her father character, holed up in the ruins of the Washiba clan's castle, who saved her in the previous episode and then kicks her out this one, who is, as I mentioned, definitely not her father, but yeah, it's totally her father. After the two idiots find Yukina just laying on a bus stop bench, and Kenosuke kind of jumps down out of the bush and finds them all again, he gets a phone call and just casually picks up and starts talking using the smartphone with Yukina's mother. And she's just like, get your ass here, you know, we got robots. And he's like, alright, I'll be there. And the other three just stand in complete awe as he's casually using a smartphone. And I just absolutely loved that scene. Given that he's kind of growing more and more used to modern technology and things like that, I thought that was a really great way of doing it. But the little argument that Yukina and Kenosuke have just shows that they have really great chemistry as characters. And it was so cute trying with Kenosuke trying to respect her decision, but Yukina wanting him to just ask her for help instead of demanding or ordering or even just attempting to respect her wishes and not ask for her help. She's just like, God damn it, ask me for help. And I found it quite satisfying how they dealt with Kenosuke's death wish by having Yukina help him overcome it. Not to say anyone's shipping anyone, but she'll give him a new purpose as his new princess. Then later on in the episode, I really loved how cute Yukina was when she was literally trying to push down within Kurumukuro. She was just pushing down as hard as she could while they were going up in the tractor beam, as if that would counter anything at all. That was incredibly cute, and her reactions have always been kind of adorable. So, you know, she's also not completely useless sitting in the back there. It's not just Kendosuke fighting and she just sits back there and looks cute. That's not how it works. She's actually quite helpful during the battle, and she's been just overall a much better protagonist than I thought she'd be. On top of that, the battle choreography and the flow, yet again, has been fantastic. That shouldn't be any surprise given the staff on this show, but I, for some reason, kind of forget that and remember once I see the battles and the flow and in general how it's directed, and it's directed incredibly well. So that continues to shine through. Next up on my list is JoJo's Bizarre Adventure, episodes 8 to 10. In episode 8, we have Yukako, who is introduced through confessing her love to Koichi. Then Koichi eventually realizing that, holy shit, this chick is crazy, you know, get me the fuck out of this. He never quite returns her feelings anyway, but she starts going over the top and, you know, completely interrupting and fucking with his life and people around him. So he enlists JoJo and Okuyasu's help to attempt to get her off his back. And I absolutely loved their suggestions to Koichi how to get Yukako to hate him. I thought they were genius and ridiculously stupid. They're just hilarious. On top of that, I completely lost it and just loved when they were talking shit about Koichi, like schoolgirls in the yard as Yukako passed them by. I just lost it. Episode 9, we see Koichi evolve into the Polnareff style of hair, and we have Echo's Act 2. I already really enjoyed Koichi's powers before when they were just sound and things like that, but now he has an even more versatile and creative stand that can be used for unique and creative uses that we haven't even seen up to this point. You know, for example, as she's falling down, he throws Echoes onto a rock that makes it boingy boingy, so she springs back up. So he's able to use Echoes too to change like properties of objects or have an effect through touching them, things like that. It's really inventive, and I'm excited to see even more and more powers. Which brings me to episode 10. Episode 10 is focused on an Italian restaurant in Morio, where that's all it is. They go to an Italian restaurant and they eat dinner. Now, I love Italian food, so this episode, you know, was right in my wheelhouse anyway, and I loved it. One thing that kind of stood out to me as somewhat annoying, though, is that fake foreign accent that people always use in various anime. Like, literally no one who speaks Japanese that fluently has an accent like that. It's kind of ridiculous, and if there's any accent at all, it's typically very faint. But I suppose that's helped to identify foreigners in anime for regular viewers. Moving on. This episode felt like kind of watching a cooking show, sort of, and I really loved it. The chef was great, and the way that they kind of shrouded him in this kind of creepy, shadowy nature of what he was doing and obfuscating his purpose and whether he was good or bad, that they really went out of their way to subvert expectations that we've set on former JoJo patterns. I really thought that was kind of creative. It was a creative use of, once again, kind of like Joker game, playing on our expectations. Overall, I'm loving part 4. You know, I love the manga anyway, so unfamiliar with this story as is, but I'm loving the anime adaptation. You know, we're experiencing really creative and interesting stand battles, and we don't even have to sit through kind of Monster of the Week globetrotting that we got in part 3. Not that I minded that, it's just I think part 4 is so much more interesting and creative overall. I was also planning on talking about Sakamoto Desuga and My Hero Academia, but as it turns out, I don't have a lot to actually add to the discussion for those two series, aside from, you know, just gushing about how much I enjoyed the manga and how much I'm enjoying their current adaptations. So I figured I'd leave those out this week, and maybe I'll talk about them again in like a season wrap-up in a few weeks. So look forward to that and maybe some other series that once they're complete, I'll talk about them again. Like some of the series I talked about in the first episode when I gave my kind of overall impressions. And that'll wrap up the weekly anime series section, and I'm actually going to move on to talk more about the single series that I want to kind of highlight this week and really dive into a little bit, which I ended up rewatching recently, so it's kind of still fresh in my mind, and I really wanted to talk about it because it's one of those series that gets very little love and attention from fans, and I would say is almost entirely unknown. If you have heard of it or seen any of it, then good on you, and hopefully you enjoyed what you saw. I did. But I'm going to talk about Hyōgen Mono. So I actually took the opportunity of the 14-hour flights to and from Chicago for Anime Central to rewatch most of Hyogemono, and I finished it after I got back. Hyogemono is one of those series that, even when it aired, it flew under the radar for, I'd say, most people. It started off in a time where there was a lot of... Okay, hold on. Let me backtrack and give some background about what this story is. Hyogemono is based on a currently ongoing manga series. It was adapted by B-Train, Studio B-Train. It aired on NHK back in... when was that? Spring 2011, I believe. And it ran for 39 episodes, so 3 core. It came at a time when we were kind of having Sengoku fatigue. I mean, I guess we still are. But it was just, everyone was thinking, oh, it's just another Sengoku series with some twist of some kind. I mean, it's true, but it's also a really poor way to write off a series as unique as Hyogemono. Let me start off by giving some background about the series. So, Hyogemono is set in the Sengoku period, and it's set in the time where Oda Nobunaga is nearing his complete unification of Japan, and the anime, in particular, the manga extends further, but the anime extends well into Toyotomi Hideyoshi's reign. If you know anything about Japanese history, you'll understand exactly the period I'm talking about. So, I know what you're thinking, and... You know, you're thinking, ah, another show about Oda Nobunaga and Toyotomi Hideyoshi and Akechi Mitsuhide. Like, I'm sick of shows set in that time period with those characters. But this is the one case, or one of very few cases, where I'd say ignore that notion. Put that aside and watch it anyway. What makes this show so special for me is that the focus is not on the period like that specifically. It's not like, oh my god, we're in the Sengoku War period, and oh my god, it's Oda Nobunaga, blah blah blah. It's actually focused more on aesthetics and the art of tea ceremonies, pottery, and things like that. I suppose to any normal person, that sounds sleep-inducing, but to me, and I think to anyone who actually managed to watch this show, it was amazing. In combination with providing these like intriguing plot developments that the author kind of uses to fill in the blanks of history regarding things like motivation and the political machinations under the surface during that time period, the blanks that we never really know about in terms of kind of famous events from that time period. I'm sure you know what I'm referring to. You know, for example, the betrayal of Oda Nobunaga and et cetera, et cetera. The author has some really intriguing and thought-provoking answers or their own theory as to how that happened told through the story. And it's incredibly interesting. If you know anything about this period of Japanese history, the series follows it quite closely, while telling a story from the perspective of a main character who isn't Oda Nobunaga, Toyotomi Hideyoshi, Akechi Mitsuhide. None of those characters are main. They're all part of the primary cast, but our main character is someone called Furuta Sasuke. Later you'll know him as Furuta Oribe, and if you look him up, you'll see that he's a real historical figure. He was a daimyo of the time, most famously known for his work in aesthetics, or wabi, and shibui, which is simpleness, things like that. His basic catch is that he's seeking promotion. He starts off as a low-ranking messenger, a vassal of Oda Nobunaga, with very little holdings and very little in way of possessions or wealth. In the start of the series, he is eager for promotion. Every time he sees these masterpieces of pottery or teacups or anything of that nature, you know, he goes wild and can't contain his excitement. Eventually, he develops relationships with various characters, and he's seeking out things like the beauty of imperfection, or in Japan it's like wabi-sabi, that idea. The beauty found in simpleness, which was prominent during that time. Hyogemono is a mix of comedy and drama. But the comedy, I would say, comes mostly from the protagonist's kind of antics and reaction to things. He is incredibly exaggerated, and that's played for great effect. due to the nature of using such a well-known period in time, the focus is actually more on the characters themselves, rather than the historical events surrounding it or the plot specifically. But you have things like the dialogue between characters is incredibly meaningful and provides great insight into their thoughts and motivations. There's no good, there's no evil in this series. It's just people trying to do what they believe is right or best. Each character we see provides kind of even greater understanding of the perspectives, the motives, the ideals, and how those things affect the world around them and the people around them and the relationships with other characters. And that's the series, I would say, strongest point. The actual characters themselves and those relationships are how the story is driven forward. It's a character-driven story. Because you can't really surprise people too heavily with such a famous and well-known time period. One of the larger focuses of the show is Furuta's, or Sasuke's, relationship with a tea ceremony master called Sen no Soeki. He later is renamed Sen no Rikyu. Now, if you look him up again, these are all real historical characters. Within the context of the show, the author uses Sen no Rikyu to explain and to fill in the holes of history in terms of the political intrigue and machinations that we see behind the scenes. So that's actually coming from Sen no Rikyu, this tea ceremony master, with his ideals in terms of Japanese appreciation of aesthetics. So he becomes a central figure in the story and helps keep the large cast of characters relevant and involved. Now, all of this is to say that despite the kind of slower and methodical pacing that Hyogemono likes to take, it kept me decidedly engaged and completely engrossed in what was happening, because the characters were so engaging, the dialogue was spot on, and I couldn't wait to see how they interacted going forward and how that affected everything else. Plus, you can never get enough of Sasuke's reaction faces. That guy is a well of pure reaction faces and silly antics. I'll stipulate this by saying I haven't actually read the manga. It's something I actually intend to get to because of just how much material left there is, and it's even ongoing now. So the anime ends at a certain particular point in history, and I won't spoil anything in case you don't know anything about history, but I'll just say it ends at what I would say is a dramatic turning point in the story for our main character. And I really want to see how it moves forward in the manga. So I will probably get to reading that at some point soon, because I love the anime so much, and I'll start over with the manga, and it'll be a nice, exciting experience. That's actually not to say that the anime doesn't come to a satisfying stopping point. Like I mentioned, it comes to a really big turning point for our main character, Furuta Oribe. Because of that, the anime itself, the adaptation, comes to a fairly satisfying stopping point in history and the story. But, you know, that isn't to say that it wouldn't be great to see a continuation in terms of plot and story. So I will probably read it, and I recommend if you haven't seen it, definitely watch it, and then check out the manga if you get a chance. I don't know how much of it's been translated, and none of this in any fashion has been officially released in English anywhere, so that's super disappointing. It was never streamed or anything like that. It's not something that you're gonna find, which is quite disappointing for me, but what can you do? Basically, if you were concerned that because it's an ongoing manga that the story doesn't finish or doesn't end at a good point, don't. It does, and you will feel satisfied with the ending, even if you don't continue reading the manga. It definitely comes to a head. I would say, don't worry about that. Give it a chance, watch it, and, you know, see what you think. This series is very niche, and it's not for everyone, and it does take some patience to get through. It is very slow, it is very methodical. There is a lot of amazing dialogue and great characters to back it up. But the plot itself, you know, it's based on real history, So you're going to be looking at things you might be familiar with, portrayed in such a way that you've never seen before, and through the lens of someone interested in something more than just the battles or the story or the history. It's a really intriguing look into the mindset and viewpoints of people on various sides of the aesthetics scale, as well as an informative take on Japanese tea ceremony, customs, and history. One other thing to mention is that I absolutely love the original opening song done by Cro-Magnon called Bull Man. And they actually co-composed the soundtrack and arranged the ending song. For some backstory to this, Cro-Magnon was a band that, during Hyogemono's airing, one of the members was, I believe, arrested or charged or something for smoking weed. And the band broke up, and subsequently the song got removed from the series and they replaced it with something else. And it's just a travesty that the song got removed and the band broke up just because of a little weed. And that's super frustrating. But if you get the chance, make sure you listen to the song in addition to the series, because the Blu-rays actually cut the song entirely, and that is just a complete disappointment for me. So look it up. It's called Bull Man by Cro-Magnon. I love it. I've listened to it so many times. You know, when I was rewatching it as well, I had to stop and I would pause before listening to the opening that they replaced it with and go back and listen to Bull Man and then skip ahead to the start of the episode, because I couldn't deal with not having Bull Man at the start of the show. It just fits so well. It's such a perfectly fitting song for a series like Hyogemono, and I felt like it was a big loss that it didn't get included at all on the Blu-ray, and that the band broke up and Anyway, that about finishes it for this episode of Docupied. Before I close out, Docupied is actually now available on basically all podcasting directories and listings, so feel free to use whatever you like to listen, and, you know, please leave me feedback, review, you know, rate it, review it on whatever site you like. I would love to read and think about what people have to say about the podcast so far, so please do that. Thank you all for listening. Make sure you follow me on Twitter. Join the Hummingbird group that I recently created if you're looking for updates on the podcast and any news like that. And make sure you follow and leave some comments on SoundCloud. You know, I'd love to read them and talk with people as well. So in between talking about JoJo and talking about Hyogemono, I actually stopped the recording and went out to dinner with some friends because I lost track of time, and yeah. So one of the friends there is actually going to be the guest for next week's episode, and that is fan translator and Sunrise Slave, production assistant, Vale. Or Vel Rocco will be joining me as the guest co-host for the next episode of Docupied. And we'll talk about, you know, the anime industry, the differences between anime industry and fan translation, because I've worked with him there. So make sure you tune in next episode for that. And I'll catch you next time.